Welcome back to another episode of the Sports Politica podcast, the show where we delve into the intricate intersection of sports, power, and politics. I'm your host, Karim Zidane, and today I'm back with another fascinating interview with a journalist who I have long admired and whom I hold tremendous respect for, John Wertheim. John is the executive editor of Sports Illustrated, where he has worked for the better part of the last three decades, covering everything from tennis to combat sports. He's also an analyst for the Tennis Channel during the Grand Slams, and is a correspondent on CBS's acclaimed 60 Minutes program. I wanted to have John on to discuss Saudi Arabia's latest developments and its unprecedented sports drive, including its recent foray into the world of tennis. This was really a free-flowing conversation that touched on a wide range of topics over the course of 45 minutes. I hope you enjoy listening to this as much as I enjoyed interviewing John myself. Happy listening. Hi, John. It's a pleasure to have you on Sports Politica. How are you?
Likewise. Good, thanks. Happy we can do this, and bear with my sparse surroundings here. This is not my apartment, but good to be here.
Well, it's always a pleasure, and thank you so much for taking the time. I have followed your work for really as long as I've followed sports and have been in this space. I've known of you and of your work, and you've been very kind and supportive of my work over the years as well. So I thought it was long due that we have this conversation, especially with everything taking place in the sports ecosystem at the moment, especially with Saudi Arabia's attempted takeovers of various sports, including the sports that both of us have covered for a long time.
But that does not limit things too much, because Saudi Arabia seems to be in virtually every sport. Whether it's MMA or tennis or soccer, boxing, this has really become a big sports story, right? I feel as though it's right now, as we're speaking, this intersection between sports and gambling is sort of the big headline. But for DraftKings and Shohei Ohtani and sports' uneasy marriage with sports gambling, I feel as though Saudi Arabia is probably the biggest story in sports right now.
Oh, absolutely, especially when we're talking about stories that have sort of geopolitical consequences and are really impactful on a global stage. I think there's something to be said about the power of this rise of sovereign wealth funds that we're seeing right now in the entire Persian Gulf, really the Arab states of the Persian Gulf. But this is led primarily by, at the moment, Saudi Arabia. Now, I watched the 60 Minutes episode that you did when you were into Riyadh, and it was a fantastic and fascinating episode. And one of the big things that you attempted to sort of discuss while you were there, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on everything from that experience. But to start this off, there was a big discussion at one point in the episode on the term sports washing. You spoke to several Saudi officials about it, asked them, well, do you think that this falls under sports washing? Is this criticism of your events and of your investments in sports? Can we characterize this as sports washing? The problem for me with this term, John, is that I've always found, especially lately, that the term is not really elaborative enough when it comes to trying to define what's actually taking place around us. Sure, there's an element of reputation laundering, but there's so much more to it than that. And based on your experiences traveling to Saudi, what do you think about that?
I guess that's a really astute point. I mean, one thing that was interesting to me is that, you know, not surprisingly, the Saudi officials denied that they were engaged in sports washing. What was surprising, they denied this was even a concept. I mean, they didn't even cop to the fact that this could be a premise anywhere, that sports would have this effect, which was really quite surprising to me. I mean, there's so many ways we could take this discussion. The Saudi officials were very adamant this is not about reputation. This is about, there's a young population. There was a sort of palpable sense of some form of brain drain. And I think there's a sense of, look, we need to, whether this is bread and circuses on the cynical side, or whether this is just sort of giving the kids what they want, there was a sense of, look, we need to entertain this young population. We have, first of all, we have this obesity crisis. That was part of the talking point. And we need sports for a healthy lifestyle. There was also this sense of, if we want to keep the young kids here and not running off and becoming expats and going to colleges and never returning home. We need to have championship boxing and WWE, and we need to have all of these trappings that you have anywhere else in the world. But not only did they deny that this was in any way sort of part of image laundering or a branding exercise, they wouldn't even admit that this was a feasible route for anyone, that they sort of didn't even accept the premise of sports washing could occur in a vacuum. So that was a bit surprising. And I was there just by happenstance. There was a tennis exhibition. So I was able sort of, because I cover a fair amount of tennis, I sort of had contacts and had relationships with the players. And there was millions and millions of dollars being thrown at these players. There were crowds that were tantamount to the crowds that, you and I probably, my high school tennis matches drew comparable crowds. So it wasn't as, the one thing that just really stuck out to me was you could not make a business case for this, mm-hmm. right? And I saw that there was a judo tournament, and we went to see, Newcastle was in town. It just so happened. And what I kept thinking is, there is no business case that could be made, at least by the metrics that you and I are accustomed to. So, right. So Dana White gets up there and he says, we had this many pay-per-views and the gate was this and the arena did $10 million. All of these metrics that we're accustomed to for assessing whether sports are successful, there was no way that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia could justify the investment in sports. There had to be something else going on, because the simple back of the envelope math, you're paying $15 million in prize money and there are 200 people in the stands. It made no sense.
Well, again, that's always been something that I've had people think about, because people are like, well, this can't be a successful event. This can't be something that Saudi Arabia intends to continue to do and pursue in the long term, because they're not profiting. And I keep trying to remind people, especially Western audiences, that's not Saudi Arabia's interest. Exactly. They're not in this for the profit. Exactly. They're not for the profit. This is, at the end of the day, a multi-pronged approach that they're taking here. Yes, there is an element of improvements of health and lifestyle in Saudi Arabia, a country that's dealing with significant amounts of obesity. Sure, but I'd say that that's quite a low-tiered issue for them at the end of the day. There's a lot of economic advantages for Saudi Arabia in terms of developing the employment market in the country. This is a country that had so many migrant workers, and Saudi Arabia's top minds, let's say, as you mentioned, the brain drain, were disappearing and leaving Saudi Arabia. So I think one of the key elements that we're seeing here and why sports is so important to them is because of the nation branding that comes from it. There were several examples of this that I thought were really interesting, John. Cristiano Ronaldo coming and playing in Saudi Arabia, competing in football as part of the Al Nassr team. They placed him in several ads where he would be dressed as in traditional Saudi attire, basically, that big thob and a ghitr on his head, holding a traditional sword and doing the dance. To me, not only could this be bread and circuses, but what it really is this reflection of this new nationalism, almost like Mohammed bin Salman is reshaping Saudi in his own image. Did you get any impression of the sort while you were in Riyadh?
Absolutely. I mean, that was part of it, right? And part of this was about attire, and part of this was cuisine, and then the players, they smoked a hookah. I mean, it was sort of you had these photo op moments. And honestly, your story was really instructive with that, how a lot of this clearly was about social media and about posts. And if you have Nick Kyrgios and he's taking part in falconry, that has real value. And if you have, even some of the Messi, some of the messy social media information that you reported, and the fact that there was a non-disparagement clause, I think some of this is about demystification. I also think that something that doesn't get discussed enough in sports in general, and I think certainly here, is this element of hospitality and what goes on in these sponsor suites and what goes on at a PGA event, certainly what goes on at tennis. A lot of business gets transacted. And some of this is about this presentation to the great millions and millions of sports fans. I think some of this is also about what goes on and what deals are being made in those tents and those temporary structures behind the golf course and by the tennis courts. But I think clearly this is not simply, oh, we're just going to cut huge amounts of checks and Rafa Nadal and Cristiano Ronaldo are going to come. They're is a lot of strategy that's gone into this. And we saw the same thing, you know, come with us. There was a very, we were sort of guests of the government, and we went there saying, listen, we want to learn more. There's no agenda here. Obviously this is a big story in sports. We'd like to learn a bit. I mean, there was no pretense. And there was this sort of itinerary, and everything from sort of the rituals to what was in the background when our cameras were rolling, it was very, very orchestrated. And I think one thing I came away thinking is, this is not just some slapdash, we've got a lot of money, we can cut big checks. This is very strategic. And I have to say that this was, you know, maybe 15 months ago, it's kind of worked. I mean, I think I can, so some of this is anecdotal, some of this is data. I mean, I think we've sort of moved beyond the outrage phase. There are now enough athletes and enough, you know, there are heavyweight fights going on. And again, Rafa Nadal is this sporting, somehow this tennis minister. I don't think he's even expected to actually compete. It's just basically an affiliation. And I've heard outrageous sums of money tossed around in conjunction with that. And there was a bit of backlash initially, but it sort of died down. And it seems as though in a very short amount of time, this has become normalized for better or worse.
You make a fantastic point. This is something that I've been trying to say, is that we are seeing this being normalized. We are seeing that people will say, well, how can this be sports washing if I'm well aware of what Saudi Arabia has been doing? As a matter of fact, all its events that it's hosting makes me even more aware of the human rights abuses taking place. And I'll say this, I'll say that's not what Saudi Arabia cares about here. It's the fact that in spite of all its human rights abuses, you are still coming not just to watch these events, but all these leagues are coming to participate, and all these athletes are going and continuing to normalize. So that's how they won at this point. We're going to continue to see this become a more consistent occurrence, really, across sports. What was once in 2016 and 2017, when Saudi Arabia would host the smallest of small boxing events, cruiserweight finals of World Series tournaments and stuff like that, there was a lot of criticism then. I remember, because I was part of that backlash. But right now, you're hosting major, major events, and the opposite reaction is happening. You're getting actual boxing media calling Turkish Sheikh His Excellency, referring to him by the honorific title he's chosen for himself as he builds this cult of personality. We are now, as media members, participating in this. So Saudi is more than victorious, I'd say, at this point.
I've noticed, too, that some of the talking points that a few years ago were sort of incumbent on the Saudis to make are now being used by the athletes and the coaches and the people who have chosen to compete there. So the same sort of talking points and the no nation, there's this whole sort of relativism and no country is perfect. And, you know, you can sort of anticipate the responses when people are pressed. Those were the remarks that used to be made by the sports ministers and by, you know, to some extent, early endeavor. Now that's the same talking points being uttered by the Rafa Nadals of the world. And I do think there are a few, you know, it's very easy to sort of say, A, no country's perfect, everyone should take the bag, and don't be moralistic. I think that's an oversimplification, obviously. But I think so, to some extent, is nobody should go there. This is sports washing, this is blood money, and it's intolerable. I mean, I do think that there's some nuance here. I do think that, you know, human rights groups will tell you that Saudi Arabia is no better now than it was 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. You know, we're barely 5 years removed from bone saws being taken to a journalist. At the same time, you do see that by most, you know, just some of this is anecdotal, some of this you see with your, there's a woman's boxing club that we visited. That may have been staged, that may have been, you know, people may have been prepped for our visit, but that never would have happened 5 years ago. You know, we often heard that, you know, women can't drive. Well, now they can drive. And I do think that there are these baby steps that people can point to quite reasonably, that the things might be trending in the right direction. There's also a lot that's very disturbing and a lot that hasn't improved. And to me, we often hear, you know, the criminalized, you know, the homosexuality is criminalized. I don't even know if that's true, because we couldn't really find that there was a criminal code, so to speak. So I also think it's a bit, it actually is, I sort of referenced gambling initially. I mean, I do think that everyone sort of held their nose in sports and said, you know, we're a little uneasy about sports gambling. There's a history of you know, competition being sullied, and if competition doesn't have integrity, what are sports left with? And everyone sort of held their nose, and now we're seeing these scandals pop up. And I do wonder what happens to this whole conversation if and when not a game gets fixed or Shohei Ohtani's translator may have gotten himself in trouble, but what happens when there is a visible human rights, if heaven forbid there's another Khashoggi situation, if there is a public behavior, you know, we have people getting thrown in prison for indeterminate amount of times for retweets, when there is a high profile human rights violation, I don't know what happens to this whole discussion that you and I are having.
Oof, you know, the problem is, as I think about that, as you're saying this, I'm trying to answer the question in my head, and I'm being cynical even right now, because I can't, at this point, I don't know if we've already seen the bone saws being taken to a journalist, as you said, and it only took a matter of weeks for the WWE to return to Saudi Arabia and for matches to once again be normalized. What sort of human rights abuse are we going to require this time for something to change? We're also seeing significant, let's call it schisms in the world right now, schisms where there's significant political divides and tribalism based on a variety of wars taking place in the world and how people view their position versus Western positions right now. And countries like Saudi and the United Arab Emirates are going to capitalize on this sort of resentment towards the West and its what's perceived as its lack of moral standards that it's living up to at the moment. This is something that I think Saudi Arabia is going to definitely be utilizing. And I've been thinking about this a lot. I was in Norway a few weeks ago for a conference called Play the Game. And it's a fantastic conference with that primarily deals with good governance in sports and sports corruption and politics of sports. And one of the things it does is it brings together panelists from across the sports space, including not just journalists and academics, but PR representatives and people who are working basically the other side. So there was one from Denmark who had specifically worked on the Qatar World Cup. And he went on stage and happily, during his talk for 20 minutes, described to us exactly how he countered the narratives of journalists. And it floored me. I was honestly appreciative of his honesty, because it woke me up to something that we're facing right now, which is the fact that these countries and these governments are hiring some of the best firms there are that exist. Money has to offer for them to learn how to manipulate these conversations and to utilize real world concerns and issues taking place around it and to flip it around. For example, in the World Cup, despite all the coverage of migrant workers, there's very significant, realistic coverage for the Qatar World Cup. A lot of those journalists were labeled as Orientalists. Right. So you were able to take this idea that, oh, all criticism of Qatar coming from the West is xenophobic, et cetera, et cetera, and apply that to actual legitimate reporting. I think Saudi Arabia is going to be very good at that, especially in the lead up to the 2034 World Cup, which they're supposed to be hosting. So I unfortunately don't have much good to say in terms of where we're progressing right now, John. Maybe you have a bit more optimism than I.
No, I don't. And I think you sort of, some of this is macro and some of this is micro, right? I mean, this is coming at a time when, I mean, never mind that there isn't necessarily a history of free press in these countries. Mm-hmm. This is coming at a time when media worldwide is under siege, when objective truth is under siege, when you have this sort of lurch towards autocracy and authoritarianism in other countries, when you have this relative, I mean, sort of everything is aligning quite nicely. And it's very easy to sort of play the moral relativism game. I mean, I do think if you want to pivot there, it's not necessarily so interesting to maybe to a broader audience, but to me, what's happening in tennis is absolutely fascinating. And in some ways it crystallizes this. And in some ways it's sort of, it's interesting that, you know, if we'd had this conversation 2 years ago, we would have been speaking about all about LIV Golf. Mm-hmm. And we haven't even mentioned that yet.
Exactly.
Which tells you something about how quickly this story is moving, but also the extent to which the Saudi presence in sports has gotten so deep that we've already, you know, talked about soccer and MMA, and there's Formula One. I think what's going on in tennis is really interesting in a couple respects. One is that clearly LIV Golf did not work, and this benefited no one. And if the, you know, if Saudis were getting into the golf space as a branding exercise, it didn't necessarily work. And if they were doing it in a way to, again, take advantage of all the business deals that get done on the golf course, didn't really work. It certainly didn't help the product of golf. And so the approach to tennis has been much, much different. And it's been a much sort of more congenial, let's work together and let's build this. And we have resources, but we want to work within the system. We don't want this, we don't sort of want this rebel competing product. That has had its issues too. And one thing that's interesting that I'm glad you brought up, that it's not just Saudi Arabia, but there have been longstanding tennis events in Dubai and in Doha, and there are other sovereign wealth funds that also want to get into this sports game. And so what you have is this very interesting sort of situation in tennis. It's men, it's women. There's a long history of activism, especially in women's tennis, which complicates matters. But what you also have are these sort of rival countries. And I didn't realize, I suspect you did, I didn't realize the extent to which there is real rivalry. Among some of these countries and among these sovereign wealth funds. And what you have in tennis, apart from sort of the usual discussion about sports washing and, you know, whether this is an advisable path to go down, you have this real backlash where Emiratis and where, you know, you have these other kingdoms that are saying, wait a second, we've been part of this tennis circuit for decades. How did these guys get to jump the line? Oh, they're contributing $1 billion? Well, we'll pay $1 billion. How come you're doing business with these outsiders? And what you realize is that as aggressive as Saudi Arabia has been, it is not the only country that is using its private wealth fund to invest in sports.
You know, Saudi Arabia reminds me a lot of the comparison I like to make is sort of, I think of it as like, And the Gulf region is like North America. The United States gets all the attention, right? It takes all the attention away from Canada, from Mexico, etc. It is the country that, you know, the gravity of controversy of anything whatsoever is going to come around the United States. And Canada can get away with a lot. I mean, Canada's not an innocent country by any means. It can get away with a lot because of just it being neighbors with the United States and the fact that the U.S. will always be seen as worse than it. This, I think, applies a lot to the Gulf region as well, with Saudi and especially its relationship with the United Arab Emirates. We're talking about two leaders who used to be very, very close. Mohammed bin Zayed of the UAE used to be sort of the mentor to Mohammed bin Salman in many ways. MBS used to take a lot of advice from this person. Now they're bitter rivals. And you're seeing that across a variety of sports. You're seeing them competing against each other in the combat sports space, where the UAE is a dominant force in jiu-jitsu, as well as being the main host of the UFC in the region. Now you got Saudi Arabia slowly trying to sneak in and take away one UFC event from the UAE, while at the same time trying to purchasing a stake in a different MMA organization altogether. I feel like we're seeing the same thing develop across a variety of sports, and tennis is the latest playground for these oil sheikhs, basically. And it does add a level of nuance that I think is really interesting. So I'm glad you really brought this up, because that rivalry is not something everybody thinks about.
I like that analogy a lot. To me, this has been fascinating to see how deep this goes. And also, I mean, to some extent, look, this is obviously, these are very, very wealthy countries. There are all sorts of ways that they can infiltrate these other economies, right? I mean, you can make your private equity investments, and you can do business with Jared Kushner, and you can play the real estate game, and the, you know, you can do the venture capital thing. It is much different when there is a photo op with Messi or Draymond Green, or with you know, the UFC fighters are coming through. I mean, I don't know if you have a stance on this. One thing that's been really just a sidebar on this tennis, it's sort of the first wide scale. We're not talking about a few women fighters who might be on a UFC card. I mean, the women's tennis is really interesting, because it seems to be the first fully female global sport that's going to make this decision. And you've had some notable players, Venus Williams quite recently, which was a bit of a surprise, but Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova have sort of said, listen, we're not comfortable here. This women's tennis tour is predicated on social justice and equality and feminism. How in the world could we, in good faith, be consistent with those values and hold a big event in Saudi Arabia. And then you have this other pushback, which I actually think is really interesting, and I'm not sure I have a great response, which is, wait a second, you know, Ronaldo's gotten nine figures of wealth here, and then Messi gets whatever it is, $2.5 million a tweet, and Rafa Nadal has gotten very fat at the trough, and MMA comes through town. Everybody else can take advantage of this wealth. Why is it incumbent on us to be the moral arbiters? We're women's tennis tour. We need to lose out on this great bonanza, on this great waterfall of money. We need to be the ones to take the moral stand, but all the men can get fat at the trough. So the women's tennis situation is really interesting, where you have this real sort of uneasiness among the players, and some of this is about homosexuality, some of this is about women's rights, some of this is just the overall human rights record. But there is this pushback of sort of, wait a second, everybody else has sort of made their choice and gotten wealthy and gotten to the trough. We're the ones that have to, you know, withhold. And to me, it's just sort of, it's interesting moral philosophy. It's an interesting argument. And it's really interesting to me that this has been brewing in tennis for a long time now. And here we are in March, and women's tennis, the agents have been told there's an event there. Apparently there's a signed contract. We've heard all sorts of things about how, but it has not been announced. And it's really interesting to me that this has still, it's still a sufficiently hot button issue that there has not been this women's tennis announcement that everybody thought was a done deal a year ago.
You know, you raise a fantastic point. And yes, there's a case to be made that why should the women be the ones to suffer or to hold back or to not, you know, make the money in the end of the day. The truth is that it's very easy for somebody to say they have morals. You know what I mean? But morals come with sacrifices at the end of the day. That's just the truth of it. And in some sacrifices, that sacrifice is money. If you're going to stand by your morals, that's going to cost you. It doesn't come for free, and actually you don't get paid for that. You know what I mean? I know that based on just my experiences in this world. Every time I've stood for what I believed in, it's come at the cost of something. Right? And I can only imagine for these athletes, the cost is far, far greater in terms of monetary and financial, whatever it may be. That's just the truth of the matter. And that's what makes it so difficult. People will always be able to point to someone else and say, why did he get to do it and not me? Why am I the one who has to take the stand? The problem is, if nobody takes a stand, then there is no stand, is there? There is no, that's the real issue. So I don't know how they're going to decide it, but I've come to a position where I'm less individually critical on people. I do tend to continue reflecting on how governments are choosing to handle this. For me, it comes down to, why did Saudi Arabia pick tennis? Apart from the fact that they're doing this unprecedented sports drive, going after as many sports as they can, especially vulnerable sports in general. Why tennis? And you mentioned it's because of the opportunity for women right there. That's something they weren't going to achieve with other sports. And if they really want to present themselves as this reformed nation, what better way to do it than to show that they've changed their presentation and their treatment of women, right? And tennis is a great way to do that, to create at least a facade of that.
Right. And again, this isn't just a woman's fight on a UFC card. This is a sport of, if Billie Jean King is okay, and she's going to come here and she's going to pose and she's going to carry the sword. And again, there's this whole sort of Instagram strategy that clearly is part of this. If it's okay for Billie Jean King, who are you to complain? And then the tennis also has, obviously, you have sort of this aspirational angle, and in a way that, you know, maybe doesn't apply to WWE and UFC. You also have, you know, the billionaires doing business in the tents. It's really, I mean, it's, to me, I think what you say is very accurate and shouldn't be lost in all this. I mean, it's the old Churchill line, and sort of once you've taken the money, you've been bought. One thing that's interesting to me, and I don't know if you think there's any room here, but when I was impressed, especially talking to the sports minister, to Turki Alsaud. He's you know, very polished and educated, and he kept talking about KPIs, this sort of MBA speak, this sort of business school speak. Key performance indicators. And again, when he was making the case, it was all about KPIs. And I kept thinking, is there any way, this is more a thought exercise for you and I than anything else, but is there any way this KPI can't be turned on its head, these key performance indicators? And sports, whether it's women's tennis or whether it's, pick your Dana White, whatever it is, says, listen, we are very intrigued by this opportunity. we're very interested that you seem to be really intent on modernizing and becoming more progressive. We're going to need to see some of these KPIs. We would love to do business with you, but before we do so, we need to see whatever. The homosexuality removed from the, you know, the public executions need to halt. We need to see a criminal code. And don't sports, I mean, I just wonder if there isn't some room for sports to negotiate and say, listen, we're not going to write this off, and we're very interested in this opportunity. We just need to see some thresholds hit before we do business with you. If women's tennis said, listen, we have gay players, they might be competing here, you can understand why they wouldn't be comfortable. If you will remove your homophobia from your penal, you know, whatever it is. I mean, mm-hmm. I just wonder if sports aren't overlooking they actually have some social and cultural leverage here. And there's an in-between saying, you know, absolutely no, you know, Venus Williams, Martina Navratilova, they ain't going. Cristiano Ronaldo, Dana White, they are. I just wonder if there isn't a middle ground here that might thread the needle. But I'm curious if you think that's naive or you think there might be something here.
I don't think it's naive at all, actually. I think that's a great point. But my opinion, at least, is that I think we've missed the boat on that. There was a period mm-hmm. of time shortly after Saudi Arabia launched Vision 2030 and started focusing on sports. I'd say around 2018 was the last shot we had at that point, where Saudi Arabia was still at the stage where it was negotiating for events, for key events, and to be given that chance. Because it was only in 2018 that it started hosting the WWE, that it's in those premium live events, let's say, rather than the non-televised small events that they were doing beforehand. It was then that they started bringing boxing events, right? They still hadn't started their domestic football league. They were slowly bringing events in, a Formula One event here or there, building their sponsorship portfolio across sports. That, I think, was the point in time where they didn't have enough leverage yet, and sports could have interfered and negotiated a bit more. But how do you negotiate with an entity that has already secured the 2034 World Cup and was handed it on a silver platter with no competition? Literally no competition. In fact, the deck was stacked in their favor from the previous World Cup in 2030 to ensure that Saudi Arabia had no competition then. So why would Saudi Arabia ever feel like it needs an incentive now to change? Any change done by Saudi Arabia will be for its own, you know, it was a decision taken by them. I simply think at this point they've risen in confidence to a point where they're not going to be taking any advice from the Western world. They're not going to be listening to any sports leaders coming from the United States and actually changing anything. As a matter of fact, I think Mohammed bin Salman would see that as a show of weakness now, based on how he's responding politically, generally with Joe Biden, for instance, right? How he's handling that relationship. I think on a smaller scale, he'd do the same thing in sports at this point.
You want another thought exercise?
Oh, yes, let's do it. I'm enjoying this.
So somebody else made an interesting point to me and said, if this is all transactional and this is all about making a business case, does all of this sort of interplay with moderns, you know, Bruno Mars was playing a concert in the desert when we were there, and all of this sort of this interaction and overlap with sports, does that not make these human rights abuses intolerable economically? I mean, let's feel, you know, we're leaving ethics aside. Just think about this. How many billions, if not trillions, do you think this Khashoggi killing cost Saudi Arabia? I mean, the amount of backpedaling, the amount of extra revenue they've had to pay Ronaldo, I mean, the sort of tax on that, the chilling effect that may have had on trade, the reputational damage, that was a trillion-dollar murder. And what this was sort of a think tank expert, but his point to me was sort of, if things aren't going to happen for human rights and ethical reasons, is this investment in sports now gotten to the point where any sort of human rights violation would be so costly and come with so much taint for the most crass transactional economic reasons? Might things improve in Saudi Arabia just because another mistake or a high profile killing or some sort of ghoulish image would be so disastrous financially to all, not just to Saudi Arabia, but now to all of these partners, all these Messis and the Dolls and Ronaldos? basically making the case, is there not now so much of economic incentive to behave well and improve human rights that it may be happening for the wrong reasons, but there's just too steep a cost to make another high profile mistake?
There's a very strong point to be made there, because I think of it politically as well. I think even if Mohammed bin Salman thinks he is in a significant political position of leverage now on the world stage, it's not what it was even in the 1970s when King Faisal was actually in charge of Saudi Arabia. At the time when he initiated the oil crisis and actually completely, you know, shut down the West supply of oil from Saudi Arabia, literally crippling the United Kingdom down to a three-day work week, when the United States, you know, threatened retaliation for his actions at the time, King Faisal said, you know, we were once a country of, you know, goats and dates and milk, and we're happy to go back to that. You know, it's no skin off my back. I don't think the world is in a position where that's possible, and I don't think Saudis are ever going to be willing to take that kind of stance again. They are far too incorporated into the world economy now, and that's purposely done. You build the PIF, the Public Investment Fund, you invest in all these entities. Well, now that risk is your risk too. You're involved in this as much as everybody else.
Exactly.
And the same for all the sports athletes and leagues that are involved. You've signed 10-year deals, 5-year deals with Saudi Arabia. You're also attached to this as well. You know, when the ship sinks, you're all going down with it. So it makes the situation a lot more tenuous, I find. And yes, does make it very difficult. But here's the thing. I don't think an incident like Khashoggi, to this day, if there's one thing I do not understand about Saudi Arabia's approach, it's why the Khashoggi murder even happened. It still does not make any political sense, economic. It doesn't even make sense in terms of revenge. There are tons of dissidents and far more outspoken people that he could have gone after that would have been, I guess, more satisfying to dismember than Khashoggi. The whole thing is so bizarre that I didn't expect that of Saudi Arabia. Here's the thing. If Saudi Arabia wants to threaten people now, as we've seen with the Messi contract that I put out, they would do it through litigation. They don't need to kill you to break you anymore. They don't. Through all these contracts that you've signed, just through litigation alone, it's the thing that will scare athletes the most, is the concept of losing money. So there you go. All they need to do is litigate at this point.
It's a fascinating story, and we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's so much to it, and it's a developing story. I mean, what we're talking about here today will change in a matter of weeks, and we could have a whole different conversation then. And it's been fascinating trying to follow this story over the past few years, follow the changes, and go from simply trying to be critical of Saudi Arabia to trying to understand the nuances of what's going on, why they're doing this, and why so many people are falling for the spell that's being cast right now, right? Like, Rafael Nadal, I have to admit, John, was, maybe I'm the naive one here, but that was a bit of a surprise for me personally. I always thought that with all the awful things I've covered over the years, and just how my job really became, you know, finding like what athletes are actually doing outside of, you know, their achievements in the ring, on the field, etc. Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer always seemed like they were like a step above the rest, really, in terms of the standard, in terms of being role models, etc. Again, maybe I'm being naive here, but it was very disappointing, I have to say, seeing Rafael Nadal happily become a tennis ambassador for Saudi Arabia and making a case for, you know, the country's changing, I wouldn't have signed this contract had it not changed, etc. And I mean, what does he know at the end of the day? And truth be told, he probably has the same non-disparagement clause that Messi does in his contract. So we'll never hear him criticize Saudi, even if he wants to, right? So very disappointing, I think.
You want a hot take on some of this?
Please do.
I think there's a lot going on. I mean, first, sort of most simplistically, we say in sports, you know, time is undefeated, right? all the great ones eventually lose it. Well, you know, money has a pretty good track record as well. The other thing I think is that athletes are by nature competitive. And I think in a lot of cases, just the same way I wanted to score more points, or I wanted to be the undefeated heavyweight champion longer than the next guy, I want more money than the next guy. And I think that this really plays into some of athletes' competitive instincts. there's a certain macho, there's a certain winning that comes with making Ronaldo and Nadal type of fees that I'm not sure other people may be as sort of prone to. And then there's also just sort of this shelf life of the athlete, where I think you get these athletes. It's interesting, the athletes they've signed, right? I mean, these are guys that tend to be later in their careers. I mean, Nadal Absolutely. May not even play there. And I think there's a sense of my earning power is going to go way down the day I retire. I need to get as much as I can while I can. And I mean, again, I think it's, look, I mean, there's so many issues in sports, right, that are fairly black and white, and doping versus not dope. I mean, I think there are so many angles to this, and there are mm-hmm. geopolitical angles, and there are moral angles. And I think mm-hmm. it's interesting. I mean, the UFC business model and the clientele and the athlete and the caliber of athlete is very different from LIV Golf and tennis, which makes this story so interesting to me that, you know, Dana White is taking the bag, but so is John Rahm and so is Phil Mickelson. And mm-hmm. it's just, I don't know where this is going to go. I mean, back to our point before, when you have Rafa Nadal saying, I've seen enough to know this country is trending in the right direction and I feel very comfortable. If heaven forbid there is a high profile human rights abuse, what does that do for the reputation that Rafa Nadal has amassed and built in 20 years? So I think there's in a perverse way, there's a lot of pressure. I mean, it's honestly not altogether different from doping. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, and to me, especially in individual sports, I wonder, athletes have so much money invested in their image.
Yeah.
They are creatures of incentives. And, you know, at some point you have an incentive to dope when you're trying to make it to the major leagues or you're trying to break into the UFC. When you have hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank and a lot of that is tied to endorsements, you don't want to do anything that's going to sully that reputation. So I mean, all of this just to say, it's a very complicated issue. It's certainly fluid. I mean, the landscape today and the topics we're talking about, we barely touched on the whole sport of golf has still been torn asunder by this. And we barely mentioned it because this foray has touched on so many different sports. It's certainly one of the towering sports stories of our times. And I have to say, I think you and I are probably more cynical than a lot of people, but whether it is, it's working, as in this sort of the magic spell and the moral justifications are being accepted. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the Saudis were saying it's working in the sense that, yes, we've now insinuated ourselves into global sports. We're getting the World Cup. Rafa Nadal is coming here, and this discussion about sports washing seems to dissipate a little with each deal we sign. So it's certainly one of the bigger stories since I've started covering sports, and in no way is this done playing out.
Oh, not even a little bit. And to wrap this up, I think I eventually am going to have to write a book, something along the lines of the book I originally wanted to pitch, let's say a year ago, is very different to the book that's taking shape now, mainly because of everything Saudi Arabia is doing and how quickly this is an evolving story. But I have one last question for you, John. And as the author of 10 books, I simply want to know, how on earth did you manage to do it? Because just writing a proposal for one is driving me crazy.
you know, honestly, incrementalism.
Fair.
Right? You write you write 500 words a day, and these books are whatever, 80,000 words. You write 500 words a day. That's not so bad, right? It's like you do that in your sleep. Someone like you who's five paragraphs a day, and 160 days later, you've got 80,000 words.
I mean, fair enough, because I don't think I can approach it any differently at this point. 500 words a day and 80,000 words eventually. Okay, I can do that.
You can do it. But you have all seriousness, you should jump on it. There's a great book here, and the fact mm-hmm. that it is, the fact that it's a fluid situation and playing out, I think, is a virtue and not a liability.
Well, I mean, that's great to hear. And thank you so much, John, for taking the time. This has been a fascinating discussion. Like you said, we touched on a lot of different topics, didn't get a chance to go too far in depth, because honestly, if we did, we'd be here for 3-4 hours. And I mean, I can't take that much of your day, honestly, as much as I would love to. And I think at some point, we absolutely do have to continue this discussion and see where in 6 months, say, the situation has evolved and taken us then. But until then, thank you so, so much. It's always a pleasure to hear your thoughts and to listen to what you have to say about stuff like this.
No, likewise. I have great regard and respect for your work. And if we do this in 6 months, I suspect it will be a very different conversation.
Oh, no doubt. I have no doubt. But I do look forward to it. And I look forward to hearing your thoughts then as well. Thank you so much, John.
Thanks again.
Take care.
Take care. Thanks.